Keep Talking exists to have conversations that might help to make a better society and a better culture. I believe that each guest has important information and stories to make public. This is the Keep Talking podcast. To support it, please take a second and subscribe to the show. It helps to make this content possible. I thought I could start with a quote from one of the most famous books in literature and transition from it to get your thoughts about relationships and begin the conversation there. And the quote is from Anna Karenina. And the quote is, quote, "Happy families are all alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way." And I know from our first conversation that you've been married now for decades. And we talked a lot during that conversation about your very popular book, The Tactical Guide to Women, and what to look out for men in trying to make shrewd, prudent choices in romantic partners. And I thought maybe if you'd be comfortable with it, I'd love to start about just to chat a little bit about the positives, the green flags, the reflections you've had in your decades of your practice. I know you've been married for decades, if I understand it correctly, too. What are the happy components, the things to look out for, the green flags that you might point men to specifically to look out for in women that they're dating, that they're meeting, that you know, dovetail pretty nicely into, you know, solid, healthy, long-term relationships?
Well, I think the green flags are, you know, sort of going back to that quote, that the green flags are, they're all the same, but they're different for everyone, I would think. And meaning that there are some basic things you can look for in a mate, male, whether you're a man or a woman. And but there are some things that I think men in particular need to be looking for when they bring a woman into their life. There are things like composure. Does she bring composure to your life? Does she... Does your life and your mission become easier when she's at your side, or does it become a little harder? There's dignity and dignity being sort of the opposite of shame, because guys get really shut down with shame, women too, but guys get shut down in their own way with shame. And we can talk about shame if you want, what I mean when I say shut down, but does she bring the opposite of that? Does she bring a sense of dignity to your life rather than shame? So is composure, is dignity, does she make you more resilient in life, or does she sort of knock down your immunity to the challenges of life? And does she bring joy? Does she bring joy to your life, or does she just make you tired? Mm-hmm. And finally, I think the last one on the list, and I'm pulling these five things from a specific thing that I wrote recently, but the last one is love. And I put that last on the list because we as men are particularly vulnerable to getting attached very quickly, to declaring our love, to getting possessive and territorial about a woman. And we do this in the name of love. And we put love ahead of the other considerations that really ought to come first, because love is great. But 10 years down the road, love doesn't mean a whole lot if this relationship is bringing misery and sadness into your life.
Mm. I was rereading the Tactical Guide in preparation for this conversation. And one of the notes I took down just this morning was kind of a throwaway line in your book about a lot of the, you know, missteps and judgment that I think you've noted in men that you've met over your life is in prioritizing the short term over the long term. And you go into some, and I know you and I share this interest in evolutionary psychology, and I love that a lot of your framework seems to be influenced or informed by that work. But my understanding is that a lot of your thinking about the missteps comes from men prioritizing short-term desire, short-term emotions over the long term. I don't know if you still agree with that, but I'd love to have you flesh that out a little bit in accordance with what you were just mentioning.
Yeah, I think I still agree with that. And that's the human condition, isn't it? That we have these minds that are always in conflict with themselves. We have the emotional side that wants what it wants right now, damn it. And then we have the rational side that is more cautious and circumspect, we hope. Mm. Sometimes the rational side is difficult to engage. And The tricky thing about the rational versus the emotional side is that the emotional side can make things, the emotional part of your brain, and I'm speaking biologically, it can make things very painful for you if you're not giving it what it wants. It can give you anxiety. It can give you stomach aches. It can give you headaches. It can cause you to not sleep. It has direct access to your body, and it can reach down and make you miserable if you're not pursuing what it thinks it needs for survival. Whereas the rational side can't make you feel anything. And I think this is one of the reasons that it's so hard to stick to a diet or pick the right person or make intelligent decisions when you're angry at your boss or whatever it is, because that emotional side has power where the rational side doesn't.
You know, a book I always come back to and think about almost daily is the book Atomic Habits, which everybody has heard of probably by this point in it's linked to the idea that people basically fall back to the patterns and the habits in their life, and that, you know, picking your habits can be extremely helpful in kind of forming your trajectory in your life. And I don't know if that's also something that you agree with, if there are hacks you've noticed or the guys that you've come in contact who seem to be very good at keeping their rational mind at the forefront, what you've seen in them that allow them to keep that perspective. And, you know, some of it I think is linked to a quote I've always loved from Warren Buffett, which is, you can always tell someone to go to hell tomorrow, of just giving your brain some space if you're in a very agitated or emotional mindset to kind of calm down. But I'd love to put that to you to learn if anything comes to mind, what you've seen in guys that can be very helpful to try to make more rational long-term decisions.
Well, so much of what we do comes down to habit and habits that we don't choose. And when we choose relationships, it doesn't necessarily come naturally to choose relationships wisely. What comes naturally is choosing relationships that we're familiar with. So a lot of guys who make good decisions, they were smart enough to be born into a very loving family where people know how to handle disputes and they know how to encourage each other's purpose and so forth. And I think that's your first strategy, is be born into the right family so that you can grow up with the right habits that are going to lead you to healthy relationships. But then not everybody makes that choice at the beginning when they're born. So when you're born into the family that has habits that are kind of destructive for relationships or life in general, then you have to pick your own habits. And that begins with the recognition that what I saw and what I learned doesn't work very well. And that may be the hardest part of the entire process, is recognizing that this thing's not working. I don't know what I need to pick, but I know it needs to be different than that. That's where you start.
Yeah. You talked about two words briefly just a minute ago, the concept of love and the concept of shame. And I'd love to dig in there a little bit. And if I heard you correctly about your view of love, and, you know, as someone myself who was raised on Disney movies and a lot of the romantic culture that surrounds a lot of American movies and TV shows, the impression that I received growing up was that love was all you needed, essentially, that was sort of the North Star for making any shrewd or important decision, particularly related to women. And you talked about or mentioned shame there very briefly, but I'd love to give you some time to talk about your thoughts on how you think about love and its importance, which clearly there is importance, I would imagine you would view about that concept, but perhaps there are other things too to keep in mind, compatibility, other things. I'd love to put that to you to get your thoughts.
Yeah, well, maybe we should define love first so we know what we're talking about. And one definition that I like comes from a professor of mine that I had way back in the day. His name is Michael Carson. He's a brilliant psychologist. And if any therapists out there are listening, he wrote a book called What You Need to Know as a Therapist. Everybody should read that book. Every therapist should read that book. It should be mandatory. But anyway, he came up with the definition, or at least he gave me the definition of love being as invested in someone else's success as you are in your own. And if you throw sex into the mix, then you have romantic love. So certainly in my marriage, I'm 100% as invested in my wife's success as she is. And she's very invested in my success. I can't measure what happens in her head, but by all appearances, she is very invested in me succeeding. She encourages me to take chances. She, she's behind me 100%. So I think as a very basic definition, you can start there, and then you can add things like compatibility. And there are certain things that people need to attend to. Like, do you have a similar energy level? Do you have a certain degree of introversion versus extroversion? These are things that matter in love. But all of that stuff, to your point, your original point, is stuff that we put first when we really should be putting it last. We should be looking at the compatibility first. And when I say should, that word should is coming from the consideration of outcomes. So if you want good outcomes, you're better off if you check compatibility first, and then you can indulge the emotions of love, because you might love somebody that's completely incompatible. I've done it. I'm sure you've done it. We've all done it. But still, how many songs out there are about the overwhelming power of love and how it can overcome all problems? You know, Beatles wrote a song, Prince wrote a bunch of songs. And there's probably 1,000 songs out there that says love can conquer everything. And that's bullshit. It can't conquer everything. And why should it?
Yeah. What about the concept of shame? You know, I know I've heard you speak about this in prior interviews about how I think the concept basically was that, and I think this comes from Ev Psych as well, the idea that in, at least in relation to men and women, what men have in terms of physical strength, and there are many reasons for that difference, I think, between the sexes, women often have advantages in social maneuvering or potentially shaming tactic. Not that men can't do that to women, they certainly can and have. But I'd love to give you some space to talk about that concept, what you've seen around shame in the past with your clients or just in the literature. What's important to know about that?
Well, again, let me throw out a definition first and tell me if it works for you. That from evolutionary psychology, and I may be embellishing this a bit, but the shame is an adaptation that gets us to slow down and check our own behavior before someone else has to do it. So when we get well-adjusted people who don't end up in prison, for example, they tend to be very good at monitoring how other people view them and what's your reputation with them at the moment. And when a well-adjusted person gets the sense that their reputation is really starting to suffer, that people are getting a little bit irritated with them, then we have this mechanism that basically says, sit down, shut up, figure out what you're doing before you make it worse. And basically the mechanism of that is to make us small and quiet. And I heard a speaker, I can't remember who it was, Will Spencer. Yeah, it was Will Spencer talking a couple of years ago about the way women use shame. Women have the capacity to use shame almost in the way that men have the capacity to use physical violence. We're big and strong. We can get physically violent. They are not big and strong, but they can use shame. They women tend to be more adept than men at saying and doing things to get other people to slow down, sit down, shut up, be quiet, get small. And if we as men are not careful, and if we grow, particularly if we grow up in an environment where shame is sort of the only way that people get what they want is by shaming others, then we are really primed to fall into relationships with women who their primary means of getting what they want is by way of shaming us.
And I'm sure this is difficult to know. How do you know the difference between, or how might you consider the difference between being amenable to reasonable feedback and someone trying to overtly shame you? What do you think about that?
That's a great question. I think my answer is that it takes practice. It takes It takes the practice of, when you get feedback from somebody, using both your internal resources and external resources, checking in with other people to say, am I in the wrong here? And being able to be very honest with yourself about when you're in the wrong, and then being able to fix it. Now, here's the other part of shame, is that if I've done something that I feel ashamed of, and I apologize, and this is a good relationship, you know, and it's a good relationship, and I haven't done anything irreparable. I haven't committed a betrayal that would indicate to the other person that they should never trust me again. If it's some small transgression, I apologize, then in a good relationship, the other person accepts the apology, and then that's the end of it. And you'll see this playing out different ways with parents and their children. You'll see the parent who never gives their parent or who never gives their child a path to redemption. So the kid screws up, and then the parent, even after the kid has made it right or a sufficient amount of time has passed or whatever, the parent is still continuing to punish them, sometimes for a lifetime. They'll reflect back on things. You'll see parents who reflect back on how their adult child acted as a kid, which is such a cruel thing to do. Good parents, loving parents, parents who have their act together, they always give their child a path to redemption. And so if a child screws up, steals someone else's toy or whatever, does all the normal things that a child does and screws up, the parent will correct them, and then they'll have the child repair whatever rift was created, and then that's it. They don't mention it again. They don't hold it over the child. They want their child to succeed. They want their child to take that path to redemption. Kids who don't get that path to redemption, male or female, well, guess what kind of relationships they're going to fall into at work, in their friendships, and in their romantic relationships?
Yeah, that's a brilliant distinction. And I wonder if you would agree, and I think you just noted this, that, you know, if you're on the receiving end of that kind of feedback, what can be very helpful is having other people who are third parties, friends, basically, who are not in the direct situation to talk to get other perspectives about what has occurred. And interestingly, I'm talking next week to Robert Glover for the second time, and I think this will begin a bit of a series on the show about focusing on men specifically, and men's mental health and relationships for men. And I know one of the themes that he mentioned to me the first time I talked to him, and he's like, he beats this drum over and over again, that one of the most important things for men to have in their life is a tribe of other guys. And I'm not sure I've ever heard you speak about that concept for men specifically, or what your thoughts are on that in a healthy man's life. But I'd love to put that to you to get your thoughts on, if you think, where that ranks in your mind in terms of how important that might be to a man as he ages, to, for example, have people to go to who he trusts for advice, for feedback, etc. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's unbelievably important. And Robert is a brilliant man, and he points to these things. You can take this up with him, but I think that he would say that it needs to be a tribe of men who are actually willing to hold you accountable. Mm. And because we were talking earlier about when shame is creeping up on you, when you suspect that someone is shaming you versus just giving you an honest feedback, that you would go to third parties. Well, those third parties need to be people that you can trust to actually hold your feet to the fire, if that's what needs to happen. You know, one of the things I've written some books, and one of the things I learned early on was I can't show my early drafts to friends and expect feedback, because they're going to tell me it's great. Even if it sucks, they're not going to point to the problems that need to be fixed. But real friends, well, no, I shouldn't say that. Friends, a different league of friends, the tribe that Robert is talking about, the tribe that will hold you accountable, them you can show the book to. Them you can get honest feedback from on your behavior. It's unbelievably important to have that in your life. Hmm.
And would you distinguish between, you know, kind of rubber stamp men or friends in your life who are, you know, unendingly supportive and would not, for example, give you critical feedback on an early draft of your book, and, you know, real friends who are supportive, but are more inclined to see your potential, and when you're not meeting it, give you feedback. Is that how you would distinguish the two? I'd love to hear what you think about that.
Yeah. And I would call the friends who are unendingly supportive or unconditionally supportive, I'd call them real friends too.
Yeah.
They're just friends that you can count on in a different way. They're not the friends necessarily that you can count on for honest feedback when you've screwed up.
Yeah.
And it's important to have both.
Yeah. Fair. I am not surprised at all since our first conversation. I alluded to this at the beginning of the conversation that your book, The Tactical Guide, became such a popular bestseller because, as I mentioned, in having conversations with friends who I've sent our interview to, that is the episode that they want to talk to me about. And there seems to be just such a deep unmet need and hunger for guys to, for example, get advice on how to pick a partner, how to pick a girlfriend, how to consider picking a wife. And I've heard you say this in other interviews that almost without exception, when you ask men who even are married, who taught you how to pick a good relationship, invariably the answer is nobody. And one of the things I would love to talk, and God, it's incredible. Like once I start to open up this subject with a lot of guys, they have so much to say, and they're obviously trying to make relationships work. And there's such a hunger in them to talk openly with other guys that they probably trust and trust their opinion about how they might think about a difficult situation that they're facing with their girlfriend or their wife, or just dating in general. That's a long way of me segueing into the subject of just men today. And one of my favorite pieces I've heard you talk about in prior interviews is about depression, and how I don't think it's any secret that a lot of people are beginning to realize that a lot of men, particularly rather invisible men on the fringes, are having a very hard time in modernity. And I got to interview Richard Reeves about a year ago, who wrote the book of Boys and Men. I don't know if you're familiar with that book or have heard of it.
No, I haven't.
He might be somebody you would get a lot out of speaking with, or at least taking a look at his book. He puts a lot of the data to the gut feel that I think a lot of guys have, that a lot of men are not doing well. And one of the things that I've remembered from that conversation is him noting that one of the many issues that a lot of guys seem to be having right now is the suicide rates. And one of the reasons that he mentioned during our conversation that guys have such a high, I think it's something like 4 times the suicide rate of women, but part of the reason why a lot of men's overdoses, for example, are so lethal is that there's no one there with them when they overdose. And it's emblematic in his mind of this greater phenomenon of just general isolation for millions of guys. And so this is a very long-winded way for me to segue into the concept of depression in guys. And maybe it makes sense to start, as we've done before in this conversation, with defining what that means. And I know you have an opinion, if I understand it, on depression that is informed by animal studies and what it means to be depressed. So maybe if we could start there with just getting your definition of depression and any initial thoughts you may have. I might want to spend a little bit of time on this topic with you, if that's okay.
Yeah.
How you would define depression and any initial thoughts you may have on generalizing about what may be causing that in this world today.
Yeah. So starting, I guess, with the definition of depression, and it's one way to think about it. And you mentioned animal studies, and I do tend to think of the core of depression as being a slowing down. So as we tend to think of depression as sadness, basically. Mm. And that's part of it, certainly is part of it. But the way you can tell when an animal, Let's talk about dogs. My brother's dog, we have a dog. My brother's dog came over a couple months ago, stayed for a couple weeks. And after my brother's dog left, my dog slowed down. Hmm. externally, I guess you could say she looked sad, but she got kind of mopey. She engaged a little bit less. She didn't do as much of the stuff that she normally does. Like, she just wasn't as active. She wasn't as exuberant. She was, every marker of her behavior was a little bit slowed down. And that's, I think, a more useful way to think about depression, particularly with men, because when men get depressed, they don't necessarily look sad. You know, a lot of times they look the opposite of sad. They can look pretty energetic. They can look oftentimes irritable, kind of agitated. But sadness isn't always what presents with men. But when a guy is depressed, something in his life is going to slow down. He's sleeping more. He's sleeping less. He's having trouble, more trouble with relationships. He's having trouble at work. He's not as productive. He's drinking more. Like, there's some sort of aspect of his behavior that has become, the word that comes to mind is retarded, meaning slowed, something has slowed down in his life. And a lot of times it'll show up in relationships. Relationships start falling apart, or relationships have been falling apart. And then that's leading him to his performance elsewhere to suffer. Does that sound like a reasonable way to think about depression in men?
I think so. And I'd love to, you know, you feel free to add anything else you might like to that, but I would love to get into some of the causes of that in your mind in modernity that are maybe causing that. And I know, just this is an Ev Psych factoid that has always stuck with me, that it's just true that most men, for example, in history, haven't procreated. I think that the line I heard once, and it may have been Roy Baumeister, said that men are nature's playthings, that they kind of stretch to the extremes in general, that you get all of the most brilliant, or many, a disproportionate percentage of the most brilliant scientists and athletes and name the entrepreneurs are guys. And the reverse is also true, that men, I think, tend to make up the disproportionate percentage of people who are very low IQ, very unproductive, et cetera. I would love to maybe segue into, in your mind, what you notice in guys is typically causing in modern times that depression. I want this conversation to be pragmatic for guys that come across it, that may be looking for new habits or a new tribe or new ideas for how they can potentially progress. So I'd love to, you know, maybe start there as well and get any thoughts you have on that.
It's a tricky question, because one of the best things a guy can do for his mental health is to be connected to that tribe, like Robert Glover talks about. And if any guy out there is looking and struggling, Robert Glover has a new tribe that he is building called Integration Nation. That I'm not a part of it, but I'm well aware of what he's doing, and I admire what he's doing. Where guys can get together and talk, and they can hold each other accountable. And I think this is something that wouldn't work so well with women. This particular thing I'm about to mention, where men in that kind of group, where they get together for the purpose of helping each other grow and for the purpose of calling each other out where we need it, that we really thrive, that men feel better when some other man is caring enough to say, you need to get your shit together in this area. You're a good guy, but over here, you're kind of fucking it up and you really need to pull yourself together. Like, that feels really good to most men. I don't know that feels so good to women. I think they connect in a different way with each other, but bringing that component into your life is unbelievably, it's just healing to a lot of men. And there are options out there that exist now because of the internet that didn't necessarily exist 20 years ago, like Robert Glover's new group. And there are other groups out there too. And, some of them are a grift, but some of them are not. Some of them are legit good groups.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not sure where I'm going with that. I'll let you talk for a minute.
Well, one of the most brilliant things I've heard you say about depression, which I think is a great framework for it, is that it's often a symptom and not a disease. And I think a lot of people, and I've heard you mention this as well, that a lot of people, I think, believe that depression is something that you can catch like a cold. Mm-hmm. And it's more complicated than that, I think, in your estimation of what depression is. And I believe the analogy I've heard you make is that it's more like a fever, like it's being caused by something else. And I know in a conversation you had with Orion Terriban, who I think is a brilliant guy, he made the observation that in his estimation, many times the depression often maps onto being low status, that can also, and thinking about just hierarchies in general, that would make some sense. So I wanted to just kind of open up the space for us to talk about and spitball a little bit about what typically can lead to that situation for a lot of guys. I know Robert Glover talks a lot about how too many men in his mind are living in the nursery, that they're socially isolated, they're living at home, they're spending all their time at home playing video games online, never going out and challenging themselves. So I'd love to put that to you and get any other ideas you may have about what may be causing really modern depression in general in guys.
Yeah. And I'm sure I'll talk to Orion again, because we chat occasionally. And I think Orion and I would say a similar thing in different terms, where he ties depression in men to low status. And I don't want to misrepresent him. I'm sure that's not the only thing, only source of depression. And I don't want to give that impression, because he's a very nuanced thinker. I would say a similar thing differently. I think that depression in men so often comes down to relationships. And that fever analogy, that's not something that I noticed or I came up with. That came from another professor of mine, Jonathan Shedler, who's a brilliant psychologist. He is, when I think of the consummate therapist, somebody who can really help you very quickly hone in on the patterns in your life that are not working, and the ones that are, and how to make some changes. Like that's the man, Jonathan Shedler. But he's the one that taught me long ago that depression is not a thing you catch. And you hear it in our language, in the culture. People say, I have depression. Sort of like, I have gonorrhea, or I have, I have this thing that happened to me. No, it's like saying, I have a fever. The next question is, okay, what's causing the fever? If you're depressed, something is behind it. It's not a condition that happens on its own. I talked about my dog a minute ago getting apparently depressed after my brother's dog left after an extended stay. Well, what is a dog? A dog is a very social creature. And that dog, as far as she knows, my dog just lost an important relationship, and her entire world slowed down. Like I think objectively, I could say she was sad, and it was reflected in her behavior. But anyway, going back to men and depression, so often it comes down to relationships with women and relationships with other men.
Yeah. Yeah. I know that one of the things that I've noticed in just your comments on the internet about interviews that you've done. And I think in general, I love the advice. I think it's very good advice to, we talked about this in our first conversation about vetting, and that, it's important to very quickly realize if somebody is not a match in whatever, for whatever reason, for you. And one of the, pieces of pushback that I think you've addressed before is that, guys that don't have unlimited or numerous options with women will often respond to you and say, thanks for the advice, Sean. The 1 to 2 options I now have with women has now moved to 0, and I'm out here vetting, but what I'm now left with is, potentially worse than what I started with. And again, this may, align with the importance of, getting your purpose together, getting your life together, trying to rise up hierarchies to improve your situation. But I just wanted to put that piece of feedback and pushback to you that I agree with you that, vetting for those kind of relationships is one of the most important things men can do and help each other with. But what would be your response to guys that have that concern or that experience and are left with basically nothing?
Yeah, that's a good point. It comes up a lot, and I struggle with this question because I'm not very good at thinking about populations and how populations work. I work at the individual level, but I do think about this question a lot because I hear that a lot. And my first response is not necessarily something that I would say to a guy who was telling me this face to face and then saying, you know, my life really sucks now because you just ruined all my options. And my first gut response is, like Jocko Willink says, good. Your problem just got harder. Good. Mm. And the reason that's good is because if you know 10 women and you think 8 of them are a good match, your standards are in the basement. Like, you need to obviously need to raise your standards because you're not thinking very, very, you're not thinking in a way that is ruling women out, which is most of what men need to be doing, is ruling women out. You think about all the women in the world, 99 point something percent of them are not going to be a good fit for you, meaning they're not going to contribute to, or they're not going to be able to going back to the definition of love, they're not going to be able to fully be in your corner because their values are different, or because they don't have the capacity, or because you have characteristics that collide, or you have goals that are disparate. There's a million reasons that a woman or a man, depending on who you are, can't be by your side for the long haul. And the number of people who can be by your side is really pretty small.
Mm. Yeah.
And the answer it's just one last thought. The answer is, it's not a fun answer, but the answer is be interesting, be purposeful, and expand your network. I don't know what the answer is beyond that.
Yeah. You wrote, and I don't think we talked about this the first time we chatted, that you write and talk a lot about purpose, how important that is, especially for guys. And I have to imagine that links into what you just noted, that it's really important to have, and this is true with friends too, to have people who support you in trying to do important and difficult things in your life. And I'd love to give a little time to that as well, the idea of purpose in men's life and how that is relevant to vetting women and finding women that are a good match. I tend to agree with that general idea that you can kind of tell the difference between a man who's doing work in his life, and it doesn't really, I know it always gets conflated with trying to make as much money as you can in modern times, but I don't think the two are necessarily linked, sometimes not in any way at all. But I'd love to put that to you and talk about purpose for guys, how you think about that in a healthy male life and how it links to that vetting process for women in general.
Well, I love talking about that. Can I ask you, what do you notice when you said, I think you said something like you can tell when a guy has some purpose in his life.
Yeah. And I think to me, right, like this is probably mostly projection from myself that I notice in myself, the difference between eras in my life where I was trying to do things or to work on projects that had a deep sense of meaning for me personally, and the eras of my life when I didn't and I was lost. Mm-hmm. And I think this is similar to your observation that I've heard you make before of how important it is for men to know why they're getting out of bed in the morning. And if you have given the deliberation, you know, and I'm speaking mostly about myself here. If I've given the deliberation and the time and the thinking to who I want to become, what kind of average Tuesday I'm looking to have in a year or two or five that would be healthy and fun and meaningful to me, what would that look like? And that's the answer that has changed in various stages of my life. For me, right now, having conversations like this and sharing them with guys that I think are desperate for the expertise and the insights and thoughts of somebody like yourself is my answer largely. And the amount of just, gratitude and meaning that I get from working on these conversations, preparing for them, publishing them, marketing them, that's something that I don't really think I know how to obtain elsewhere. And so I don't know if that answers your question, but for me, that's, and I mostly can tell that in my energy level. I've had James, I don't know if you know the name James Hollis, but he's one of my favorite writers. He's a Jungian therapist, and he was just on Huberman's show a month or two ago. So his notoriety is increasing. And he talks a lot about the importance of noticing your energy levels, and that when you're doing things that mean something to you, the energy is there. And that even if it's difficult, and I think a lot of this is linked to a lot of Viktor Frankl's work with logotherapy, that I'll butcher the line, but it's something like he who has a why can endure anyhow. And that's very important to grapple with, I think, for me. And I think that must be true for a lot of guys in general.
Yeah. And if I understand you right, it sounded like you hinted earlier that you can sense that on a guy when he has that, when he has his purpose sorted out.
I think so. Yeah. I think in conversation, that's something that is, it's the difference between, generally speaking, having, you know, excitement and energy and a lot to talk about that you want to share that's exciting, versus just basically looking and feeling exhausted all the time or depressed.
Yeah. Or irritable or angry or alcoholic or, you know,
definitely
all the things that men do when life is not going well.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, and we do some interesting things when life is not going well. Some of us get sad and we get immobilized by that, but some of us go gambling, some of us go drinking, some of us go whoring. You know, we do things that tend to get pretty self-destructive. And you hinted earlier, you were talking about this idea of knowing what your values are. And that's a tricky thing for a young guy, because you and I both had eras in our life where we were on track and areas where we were not on track. And one of the areas where I was not on track was late teens, early 20s. And I knew generally where I wanted to go, but I had no idea how to get there, had no support, had no pathway. And I was lost. I was grumpy. I was miserable. I was kind of an asshole because I was not, you know, things were not going my way and I was mad at the world. And in the course of my studies to become a psychologist, I came across some behavior work by some people like Stephen Hayes, Kelly Wilson, Kirk Strosahl, and they talk a lot about values. And the reason they talk about values is because when somebody is trying to get out of whatever's causing their depression, whatever's causing their anxiety, one of the things you can point toward is your values. And it's important to their stance is that it's important to know where your values lie. And the way they define values is kind of similar to what I think you were talking about a minute ago, which is what's the person you want to be in any given situation? So, okay, if religion is one of the things that's important to you, what's the person you want to be on an average Tuesday in relation to religion? If family is important to you, what's the person you want to be? In our case, what's the man you want to be in relation to family? And so when you're a young guy, and I think life would have been easier for me back then, If I had thought about, okay, I don't have the answers right now, but I at least can define what's important to me, and I can take some little step in that direction today. I can take one little step toward the man I want to be in this realm of my life. Then that question of purpose and values becomes a lot more manageable.
Yeah. I know it was just Father's Day, and I know we're getting sort of close to the end of the conversation here, and I wanted to make sure I gave some space to talk about this in general. But this past Sunday was Father's Day, and I've been reading a bunch of essays about, you know, men in modern society, and this was something that Richard Reeves, when I talked to him, talked to me about scripts. Male scripts, or more precisely, the lack of male scripts in modern culture, and how in the absence of male scripts in terms of what it means to be a successful masculine person, in that vacuum, I think in his mind, explains the rise of somebody like Jordan Peterson, and more damagingly in his mind, the rise of somebody like Andrew Tate. And I wanted to make sure that I gave some time for us to talk about how you think about, you know, male scripts or the lack thereof, in particularly a healthy male script, for what you know, traditionally may have been there for guys even 50 years ago, maybe even 30 years ago, that is not really in the water of places like the United States anymore, at least in most of the pockets of the country. And I know you have a daughter, and I'd love to just put that to you as well, and get your thoughts on, if you agree with that sentiment, what you think that lack of script may be doing to men around the country, and maybe even more specifically, that very often that men are often portrayed as bumbling idiots, as the threat, as not to be trusted. I know these are themes that you've talked about a lot before, that some of this is just overt, and how you think we might be able to course correct if you agree with that general sentiment about the time we're living in.
Well, help me understand, what's an example of a script?
A script would be an archetype, a type of person that is typically trumpeted or encouraged in popular culture, in education, in movies, in music. Obviously, this is oversimplifying, but I think it was Richard's belief, and I think there's some reason to believe that he's right about this, that a lot of what has happened as modernity has come around is that there aren't as many places for young guys to look to for what it might mean to be a healthy and successful guy, particularly guys that don't have fathers, or fathers that they, you know, particularly get along well with or look up to. Again, I don't know if you agree with that general idea, but I know I've heard you talk in the past about how in your profession, and maybe it makes sense for me to just quote this, because I jotted this down from our first conversation, and I wanted to read it to you, that and this was from 9 or 10 months ago, and you know, obviously if you change your mind on this, I'd love to get your thoughts. But the quote was, quote, "Men are the problem, women are infallible, and that's pretty much a common sentiment in my profession. That is not the experience of your average guy who's having trouble with relationships." Obviously, this is completely out of context, but my understanding in your world and some of your beliefs about the APA is that, you know, men are not are maybe intentionally or unintentionally being deflated in how they might look at themselves with some of the messaging that they're receiving from culture right now.
Deflated is a great word, and yeah, I wish I had come up with it to describe the way the APA and most of my profession approaches men. I came across an article, I was on Apple News a couple days ago, I can't even remember what the specifics were, but it was a female writer talking about how she doesn't like the way men are behaving in society right now. And this would be a much more meaningful example if I could recall exactly what she was complaining about. But she was complaining about, you know, some generalization that she had about men. Men are too concerned with status. Let's just say it was that. That wasn't it, but that's close enough, that men are too concerned with status. And she just didn't like it. And that was the point of the article. I don't like this thing about men. And it seems like there is a drumbeat from culture and from schools of education and from psychology that, hey, we don't like this. We don't like that. We don't like this other thing. We don't like this fourth thing that you're doing. All these things that you men are doing, we don't like it. We don't know what we want instead, but we just don't like that. Mm-hmm. And that's the constant drumbeat. You guys are doing it wrong. Whatever you're doing it wrong. And when I see guys get to the point where they say, you know what, fuck off, I don't care what you think about what I'm doing, that just warms my heart, because that is where I think most men need to come from. They need to come from a point of, this is what I'm going to try to accomplish in my life, and I don't care if you don't like it. I don't care if you think I'm too concerned with status. I don't care if you think that I'm not polite enough. I don't care if you think I'm too polite. I'm going to do what I need to do to get where I want to go. You know, and I'm assuming we're not talking about sociopaths here, which we're talking about within the realm of not hurting other people and pursuing your goal. But in terms of script, I think that, you know, there are societal scripts, which I'm not particularly good at talking about, but then there are individual scripts where a guy decides that something is important to him. It's religion, it's family, it's community, it's his health, whatever it is. And he's going to do what he needs to do to get there. And he's not going to seek the approval of the APA or a journalist at Apple News or CNN or, you know, screw those people. I need to do what I need to do.
Yeah.
And it was pretty inarticulate. But, maybe that's because the emotions get activated a bit around this topic.
Definitely. And I have to imagine you've seen this a lot in male clients that have come and talked to you over the years. And, you know, I think and this is straight up Robert Glover ideas that in his book, No More Mr. Nice Guy, that often when you assert yourself in that way, and again, conceding that this is probably going towards some, you know, clearly like legal and societally beneficial endeavor that you've decided to do, the pushback that those guys may be receiving from others that are accustomed to them not asserting themselves, not prioritizing their health or their career or their advancement. What type of advice would you give a client who comes to you and is struggling with that they're accustomed to being the nice little boy, and now they're growing up a little bit and they're doing what they want and what's important to them? What kind of things would you point them to keep in mind as they're going on their own journey, their own purpose?
Well, I'll back up a little bit and say that I'm pretty old school as a therapist in that I don't give advice. And what I mean by that is, if somebody's coming to me because being a nice guy has not worked out for them, then the task for me is to help them tear apart that pattern and figure out what's working, what's not working, where do they want to get to in life, and what trade-offs are they willing to make. And so part of the trade-off is when you start becoming apologetic about your purpose and your goals, that some people don't like it, but other people, they really dig it. And it's a scary thing for a lot of guys to take that step of displeasing other people, particularly if they're important people, if they're families or girlfriends. But, you know, some guys find that when they start unapologetically pursuing their purpose, their girlfriend, for example, might not like it, and it might end the relationship. Other guys find that she kind of digs it. Like, she likes this guy who's finally showing up. And maybe that's the person to have in your life, is the person who digs the guy who's actually showing up.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd love to give some time to, if you're comfortable talking about it, because I know you have a young daughter, and I've heard you speak about this a little bit in a past interview about advice you have for her as she is getting older and may want to start either her own career or to start meeting guys. I know I've heard you quote Thomas Sowell before, which it's one of my all-time enduring favorite lines, which is, you know, in life there are no solutions, there are only trade-offs, which I think is such a pithy, accurate way to think about decision making. And and it may make sense to close, because I know we're getting close to the end of our time together today, but for how you talk to her about her trajectory. We spoke last time about the tragedy that I've often seen in women who are roughly my age, who are in their mid to late 30s, that tragically wake up and are freaking out because they think they've run out of time, and maybe they have, to have families. I'd love to close on that and get any advice you have for women that are listening to this, about advice that you would give your own child, about how to think about balancing career, family, dating, et cetera.
Yeah, this is one of the tragic lies that society tells young women, and society tells tragic lies to young men, like, you should be the nice guy and you'll get what you want. You know, people will return your kindness. Some will, some won't. And it's pretty heartbreaking when they don't. But one of the great lies that we teach young girls is that they can have it all, and you can have it all. You know, guys, I think guys understand this implicitly, that no, you can't do everything. It's just not all going to work out for you. But we tell little girls that they can have everything they want and they can have it all at once. And that's not the case. As my daughter, she just graduated high school and she's getting ready to go off to college. And so we've been having some conversations about what she wants to do with her life and what the trade-offs might be. For a short period, she was talking about medical school, and I think she was doing it because she felt like she was supposed to, but that's neither here nor there. One of the conversations we had about medical school was not to encourage her or not to discourage her, but to say, look, this is a really long, hard path, and these are the things you're going to have to give up to get there. That's the part that's missing in our conversation with young girls, is this is what you're going to have to give up if you want this thing over here. That's fine. Get that thing over there if you want it, but don't get all pissy when you don't get these other things. More importantly, that's not a very productive way to say it. I think a more productive way to phrase that would be, don't be surprised when you don't get these other things.
Yeah, fair. Man, thank you again so much for doing this. I love your work. There's so much more I could have talked to you about today as well, but maybe we can do this again at some point in the future and keep a conversation alive. But I just want to thank you again for all of your public appearances and interviews and writing and work that you do. It's an honor to do this. So thanks again.
Well, Dan, thanks for having me on. It's really good to talk to you again. Hope we get to do it again sometime.
Would love that. Thank you for listening to this episode of Keep Talking. If you're finding value in this podcast, please consider supporting the show via the links below on Venmo, PayPal, or Patreon. Your support helps to make these conversations possible.